smokestack. Drivers are rolling on, leaving me here behind. Give me back them good old days and let me ramble down the line. To hear the whistle blow. She's taking the sun and leaving the rain and making me want to go. I've got the blues, longing for her company. It's many miles from where I am to the only one for me. It's so lonesome here, waiting for the manifest. I hope that engineer is kind enough to let me be his guest. Pound to me, take me everywhere I want to go, get my transportation free.
This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk. WAFT Champagne 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board. Today is Sunday, November the 24th. This is the Sunday before Thanksgiving. And you're tuned to the Prairie Monk Program, WEFT's weekly look at rails, trails, greenways, conservation, everything that Dave has been up to, including a special interview that we'll be dropping in for the better part of this hour.
The Grand Prairie Friends had an annual general meeting at the Barnhart Prairie Blue Stem restaurant, and it was very well attended, probably over 200 people there, and this was their 35th anniversary, and they've done very well. They've not only preserved prairie and been advocates for prairie, but they've also acquired land in Colts County especially, which is oriented to forest and prairie. The prairie is on fingers that were farmed, so it will be reconstruction prairie. And the forest has probably been cut over in its day, but with donations and grants and volunteer donations and volunteer services, the Grand Prairie Friends now has well over 1,000 acres of land that they own, plus they supervise land for other people and do things like prairie burns. And they invited Wendy Garrison in here, and so we will hopefully have a brief interview with Wendy. She came here out of interest, decided to do a master's degree in biology, met up with someone with similar interests in biology, and he got a job in Mississippi, so he returned there. She hasn't been in town for 35 years, But even a little before that, she was instrumental in working with a number of different people to put together a prairie conference at Mahomet, and then to also put together membership of Grand Prairie Friends. She was a member and a board member of Educational Resources in Environmental Science. It was exciting to have her here because she paid for the first 1 mile of short line prairie near to Gifford, which was the first acquisition that helped to form the Grand Prairie Friends. So several of us walked the trail 1 mile long and chatted with each other, and we'll hope to have some of that sort of information on. So without further ado, let's see what we can do. This is a little experimental, so we're crossing our fingers. We're ready to go.
This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WAFT Champagne, 90.1 on your FM dial, and I'm talking to Wendy Garrison, who was here some 30 years ago, and she's been invited back. There was a huge meeting for Grand Prairie Friends today, and she's been invited guest. And we walked the short line, and I'd like her to give us some idea of her background. She might even reminisce a little bit on some of the things that she encountered when she was first here.
My background, I guess I've been an environmentalist my whole life. But
were your parents environmentalists?
No, not at all. My father, one time I tried to get him interested in going camping. He goes, "No," he goes, "I work hard. I don't want to sleep in a tent. I want to sleep in a nice bed." I mean, he was the nicest man in the world, and he encouraged me in my interest, but he himself did not want to go outside. If anything, maybe it's atavistic, goes back to my grandfather, who collected books. Well, he was a physician, and so in his library he had books about plants, because in those days physicians studied botany, and so he had all these beautiful books about wildflowers, which I now have. So if anything, that interest in nature goes back to my grandfather, although I didn't directly learn it from him. And then I remember I had a stamp collection from the National Wildlife Federation, and they sent out stamps every year that had beautiful animals on them and plants. And they sent out books so you could put all the stamps that you collected in these books and keep them in a binder. And I did that.
So you're a collector also?
I don't go out of my way to collect, but I just love these stamps and I love the animals on them. But eventually, when I moved to Champaign-Urbana, I met Dave Monk first thing almost. He probably had me out there on the prairies before anything else. Sharing his interest and enthusiasm for the prairies with me. And I went back to, I already had a bachelor's degree, so I went back and got my master's.
But you came here because you were interested in just coming here. You didn't come here to do a degree.
That's right. I didn't come here for the purpose of getting a degree. It was nothing that organized. It was just life.
Yes.
You know, so.
And then you decided to do it.
That's right. And I was in my 20s, and you know how you are when you're in your 20s. And then I decided to go ahead and go for a master's degree.
In what sort of biology?
Yeah. That was just a general degree in biology.
Uh-huh.
And in that degree, I did some research. I did research on double-seeded acorns of bur oak.
Double-seeded?
Double, like two.
Yes, yes.
You know how acorns usually have one seed inside the acorn. But they have the potential to have up to six seeds. Every acorn does. But it just so happens that over time, only one of those seeds develops, usually. But sometimes you would open an acorn and there'd be two seeds in it. You could tell there were two because they were divided by a papery, you know, thing that separated.
Uh-huh.
And that was, so all oak flowers have the potential to make six seeds, but most do not. So I collected all sorts of bur oak acorns, and then I looked at the frequency, how many of them had double seeds, the percentage of double-seeded acorns, and then I speculated about what evolutionary advantage that might be, because nearly all acorns were infested by weevils of some
yes.
sort. Yeah, as I found out after I collected bags of these acorns.
And then the prairie weevils. Plants have weevils too.
Yes, almost everything has
yes,
something.
Yes, weevils. They have a long proboscis.
Yeah.
Then you met people here.
Right, I met other people here who were interested in the prairie. I guess many of them I met through Dave. Some I met. I worked at for the Army Corps of Engineers Environmental Division at the Construction Engineering Research Lab. At Searle.
Yes.
Searle. And that was right before and during the time I was starting to work on my master's degree. And
You met your husband here.
Right. He also worked in the environmental division. He worked in acoustics.
In Searle?
Yeah, at Searle. And I worked in natural resources. And so that is where we met. And he came from a family that also loved nature, like I did. And so we just, you know, found that we had a lot in common.
Uh-huh.
And enjoyed going to the Smokies and camping there, things like that. And he wholeheartedly supported my research. So many a day I would go out, and I'd be collecting bur oak acorns, and oftentimes on a weekend. And when the University of Illinois had a home football game, when they scored a goal, they would set off a cannon. So many times I'd be out studying acorns and we'd hear the boom of the cannon, and we would know that the Fighting Illini had just scored a touchdown.
Wow. Your husband got a job in Mississippi, which was sort of his home territory.
That's right. So now I get asked all the time, well, how did you end up in Mississippi? And I say, well, I'm married a Mississippian. So he was not born in Mississippi, but raised in Mississippi. And he always wanted to go back to Mississippi. And as you might know, Mississippi is money poor, but it's land rich. So money poor, but land rich. And so it enabled us, our move enabled us to buy 100 acres, which we couldn't do in Illinois.
Yes,
absolutely.
It'd be $6,000 an acre here.
Yeah, and it was at the time it was maybe $500 an acre there. Uh-huh. And we bought a little farmhouse that just happened to be on the land, maybe from the 1930s. And it was very simple farmhouse. It was not a shack, but it was very basic, and it was constructed of pine. Mm-hmm. And it had a little porch on the front. And we lived in that house for 12 years. We fixed it up, some things we had to do. But basically it had no central heat, no central air conditioning, it just had a space heater in the place where the fireplace had been.
Was your washing machine on the front porch?
No, but they had closed in the back porch, and that's how you got to the bathroom, which clearly was not part of the original house. You go through what had been a porch and into the, you know, the added-on bathroom. But we did. We put our washing machine in the kitchen.
Southern houses often seem to have utilities on the front
yes,
porch.
Well, on the back porch, I just thought of this. When you said that, there was a freezer, a huge freezer, because all Southern families they put up their vegetables and they froze them in venison and deer meat. They would hunt and they would freeze it. It was just, I think most every southern house had a big, huge freezer. And when we bought the house, that was there. And we really never used it because we don't hunt and we don't farm. So,
yes.
So that freezer, but it was too big to get off the porch because I think they had built the porch around it, sort of.
So you did a PhD in Mississippi?
Yes. So in Mississippi, yeah, I got my master's degree here in Champaign-Urbana. But in Mississippi, oh, here's something, I don't know if you know this, but when I first moved to Mississippi, the activist in me got a recycling center going there.
Ah.
Yeah, so I joined the Sierra Club and then...
Not easy to go do.
No, and we got the city on our side, so I spent many a day going around to the city offices. I spent a lot of time in City Hall, and then equal amount of time at the city shop. And they all knew me, and they sort of liked me, but they would see me coming. And I remember one man, I walked in his office, and he spun all the way around in his swivel chair. He was like, okay, Wendy, what do you want?
Yes, you have that sort of interaction. I remember a mayor that once said, I can't touch you with a 40-foot pole, but what do you want?
and
I got what I wanted. I wanted a no more policy on the entrance to the community.
Oh, yeah, the corridor there. But, so I eventually got the city of Oxford. I was not a Southerner, they didn't know me, but I think when people see that you're doing something for the right reasons,
uh-huh.
and that's a good thing, and you really believe in it, they get over on your side. So I got all these city officials on, well, I say my side, but the side of the Sierra Club and the group that was interested in starting the recycling center, and they got behind it, and they provided a lot of the manpower and the space for us to do a recycling center. We had a pickup, we had a buyback on like first Saturday of each month where people drove up in their cars and unloaded newspapers, and we had a scaffold there which we had bought, and we weighed their stuff and we paid them by the pound.
Uh-huh.
And the city let us, well, it was, you know, it was a joint effort, and we set up on city property. So it gave it a lot of respectability. And that went on for a year and a half or 2 years. And when it ended, the reason it ended was that we were selling it to markets. We weren't just collecting it. We were selling a newspaper in, I forget where, and then the glass went to Atlanta.
Uh-huh.
And they recycled the glass. And eventually the market just said they didn't need any more glass and they couldn't use any more newspaper. So what a lot of people don't realize, it's easy to collect materials. Yes, you put out a bin and then you pick it up, but then where does it go after that?
Yes.
And if you're doing it right, you have a market for it and they buy it and they use it.
Now it's getting interesting. The world is getting short of sand. And guess what sand makes? It makes glass. So you could, if you could sort it out and put it in a mountain, perhaps in another 20 years, you might need that glass.
I know. Glass is so beautiful. It's so natural. It just goes, I feel like it goes back to nature.
Yes.
And I have at least one bottle tree in my yard.
So, but what did you do? How did you morph into a PhD?
Well, I just decided that, I'm not sure the order, but that was sort of, I guess I wanted the highest degree in my field, and the University of Mississippi was right there. And as soon as I visited it, I knew that I belonged there. You know, when you go somewhere and you not only you want to be there with all your heart, but you
yes.
feel like you already belong there. And that was how I felt when I walked in the biology department building at the University of Mississippi. And it was, and still is to a large degree, organismal biology. That is, they have some cell biology, they have DNA biology now, population biology, but they also have people who study the individual organism, whether it's a plant or an animal.
So there are specialists as well as generalists.
Well, specialist and generalist, yes. And then you can, but you can specialize at different levels. Like yes. You can specialize, say, animal behavior. What sort of courtship rituals and dances uh-huh. do they do? Or you can specialize at the population level, like at the larger level, and see how populations differ of the same species in
yes.
different regions.
How lemmings drop and then build up again, drop and build
yeah,
up again.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, so fluctuations in population. Or you can go down to the cellular level, the smaller level, or you can go down to the molecular level and study DNA. So they're all different sorts of levels where you can study biology from. But what appeals to me is the organismal level, like the uh-huh. plant
okay.
itself.
So you did more botany than you did zoology.
Yes, so I got interested in functional morphology. That is what the form of a plant can tell you about the function. And as you know, you're sort of an artist, among other things, and you know that plants have sometimes beautiful structures.
Yes.
Especially their seeds and their fruits. So I got interested in why. Well, you can't ask the question why, you have to have a hypothesis, but if you look at a seed pod, why does it have that design? What is it doing?
I go to the farmer's market and they experiment with what they grow, and there's a prickly cucumber, and I really wonder why it's a prickly cucumber.
Yes, exactly, that sort of thing. So, and you wonder, does it discourage predation, or is there some other reason it's the prickly cucumber? And so the hypothesis that I ended up testing, I ended up working with ballistic seed dispersal, which means the plant throws its seeds explosively.
Yes, there's a little cucumber that does that too.
Yes, the squirting cucumber.
Yes.
Yes, yes.
Did you study it?
No, but the funny thing is I there was a conference when I was just a graduate student, and I was an older graduate student. It was at Kew Gardens in England, and I saw a flyer for it in the biology department, and I said wistfully, probably in the hearing of the department chair, I said, oh, I wish I could go to that conference. And he looked at me and said, well, what's stopping you? He said, what's stopping you from going to that conference? I was like, oh, well, I mean, I'm just a graduate student. I could do it. And he goes, the department will help you get there.
That's nice to have people yes. doing that. So.
Yes. So I did go and give a talk on some of my early research at the Linnaean Society in London. Got up on the stage there, it took every ounce of courage that I had to do it. And then the BBC interviewed me about my work.
And it went all over the world.
Yeah, I guess.
Because England was still an empire to some extent.
And then they asked me, or somebody asked me, well, do you have a copy of the tape and we could listen to it? I said, no, I did the interview, I don't want to listen to the interview myself. But yeah, they sent me a little postcard and thanked me. I think maybe they paid me a little stipend. So that was a big deal to me to be on the BBC radio as a graduate student. But anyway, but when I was over there at the Linnaean Society, I finished my 15-minute talk, and there was a question and answer, and one man said in a very British accent, have you applied your theories to the squirting cucumber?
Yes, academic questions can sometimes be flooring. You don't know quite how to answer it.
So that's how I know about the squirting cucumber. But I studied a lot of different legumes, you know, the bean and pea family, and a lot of those will split. In fact, wisteria. Have you ever collected
yes.
beautiful wisteria pods and had them inside near a heater, and all of a sudden they
right.
fly up and
yes.
There are several other species of fruits of legumes that do that. That have ballistic seed dispersal. So my hypothesis was that it's an advantage to them because instead of the seeds just dropping straight down, it throws them out in all directions and perhaps gives them a better chance of getting established.
We have a New Jersey tea here.
Oh yeah.
And it dehisses. If you bring the seed in and put it in a room that has four walls, the seeds hit the walls.
Isn't that wonderful?
It takes them away from the brother plant.
Yes, it takes them away. And so I did some studies that showed that the angles that they're ejected at, I did high speed photography, but I know it's so simple and easy to do that, but I did it with strobe light and motion detector inside of a darkened box. And I did show that the angles that the seeds were ejected at were near the best to get them furthest. In other words, they weren't shot straight down, they weren't shot straight up, but they were shot like whatever 45 degree angle.
And so you taught these sort of things to students?
Yeah, I taught them to the students. Mostly I taught introductory biology, which was really quite wonderful, like introducing students to the concept of natural succession and all the theories that go with.
There was a move more towards environment than there was to physiology or taxonomy.
Well, I got the higher level classes. When I taught botany, I taught straight taxonomy, that is plant identification, and the students were able to key things out. They were able to identify things in the field, and I did have a student many, many years later say, Dr. Garrison, when I went out to the rail trail to walk, I recognized all the plants because I remembered them from your class. And I do think we need to do more of that because there's been a move away from identification.
Yes, it is. And Linnaean identification has changed some as plants, the DNA and RNA has been checked, and they have different relations to other plants.
Exactly. So the families that I memorized and know, those changes, they find that DNA shows this group is more closely related to this group and not as closely related to the groups we thought it was. So you're absolutely right.
So there was at the short line the other day, one of the first things we saw was a little berry that belongs to the tomato family.
Yes.
And there's a question of whether it related to a tomato or whether it related to a potato. And so it went on for a little while.
Yes, and by the way, we were laughing that, like, don't eat those because they're poisonous, but there are a lot of poisonous things in the Solanaceae. Which is really the nightshade.
Oh, yes.
So, in fact, tomatoes are a bit poisonous and some people can't tolerate them, and potatoes are little, you know, the alkaloids in them.
Yes, we were not advised to sell potatoes that were green, that had sun on them.
That's right.
For that same reason.
Yes. Yes.
So, you've been involved in gentle activism. And
yes,
the university studies.
Yes.
And so you've been brought back here because you kindly helped buy the short line.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And several of us walked the short line with you the other day. But after you had bought it, you were still here for 2 years. And I think you used to visit it quite a bit. Tell us a little bit about it. How you enjoyed the short line.
Well, at the time, like, we bought it, then we started Grand Prairie Friends of Illinois, and they eventually took over ownership. I don't quite remember all the steps, but I used to go up there all the time to botanize and look at things. And here's a funny thing, is one time I went up there and there was a crew up there taking out the tracks. They were going to sell them for salvage and recycle them, the steel in the tracks. And I mean, you never knew what you would come across up there. So I struck up a conversation with the guys, and it turned out that one of them told me he had sung with the rock group Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs. That was like Willy Willy. It was a group that was popular in the 1960s. So that was one of the funny things I came across. And then another time, I was teaching reading the landscape at Parkland College, and one of the students in my class said, I'd taken him out to the short line, and he did woodworking, so he made some very nice signs for each end of the short line that said Grand Prairie Friends of Illinois, and we, you know, put them up there. And then one day I went up there, and someone had pulled up one of the signs and set it on fire, and it was still in flames when I got there. So I was very sad, and I was frightened, so I didn't even walk on the shoreline at night, because I was by myself. And
yes, and it's not easy. Some people were wanting those corridors back for more agriculture.
Mm-hmm. But that was probably the only instance we had of any bad feelings toward the group. That maybe there were some, or maybe it was just some vandals out having fun. I don't know. But
you used to work with Susan Smith.
Oh, yeah.
And you got to be friendly there. And she's an activist from Homer.
Yes, and she is a farmer. It's from her husband's family has been farming for generations.
Yes.
So that's what I really like about prairie activism. It's not just a certain kind of people. It's all kinds of people. And so it's very valuable and meaningful to have people that farm for a living who are also activists and interested in prairie life.
Well, Susan didn't come from a farming background. She had to learn how to be a farmer's wife.
Yes, she probably did. That's right. And then she sort of brought, I don't know who brought who into the environmental side of things.
Yeah. Well, father-in-law is very much into Audubon and a whole bunch of things in Vermilion County. And has always been, the family has been involved in environmental issues.
Yeah, so she was in that original group when we were, I guess, writing the bylaws for Grand Prairie Friends. And I just remember walking the short line with her many times. And when her daughter was a baby, Suzanne took the baby out in one of those pouches, you know, and walked the short line with her baby in a pouch, and this little baby's now grown up and living outside the country and teaching outside the country. So it's just neat to have those relationships that you form with people as you're working
yes.
with the land.
The person who mows the ballast came by after you had left. And he knew about the fact that you had a picnic table there. Tell us about the picnic table.
Well, when we were walking, was it just yesterday? Yeah, and Suzanne and I were reminiscing that when we first got the short line and we had dreams and visions for it, many of which have come true, one of our visions was how neat it would be to have a picnic table under the trees. There's some walnut trees in the middle. How neat it would be to have a picnic table there so that you could bring your lunch and just sit under those trees and eat your lunch and just, you know, be very still and quiet and look at the nature that was there. And as we were walking, we couldn't remember if we had actually put a picnic table in or not. It was very real to me. I remember having the discussion, if you have a picnic table, then should you have a trash can, and if you have a trash can, then who's going to empty it? So I remember it's funny, the things that you remember. But so we kind of dropped that subject and started talking about other things. And when we got to the middle of the short line, there was the remains of a picnic table.
Yes.
So we deduced, I guess we put one out there all those years ago. It was in bits and pieces and it had fallen to bits. So I don't even know if a picnic table would last 30 years under the Illinois sun, or if that was our original table, or what
I think it was your original table, the gentleman that was on the line, who also worked for us, Illinois Central, on that line, making repair to equipment to put in spikes and tighten bolts and things like that. But his father used to be a fireman on the steam engines that went to Pontiac and back to Champaign. and they'd turn the engine on a turntable at Pontiac so that the engine could go front ways. And it had to be turned by hand because it didn't have a power to it. But it was very well on ball bearings, so you could move it that way. It's a very heavy engine, but so it would find the line and go front ways again.
And this was a man who just happened to be there yesterday.
Well, he was walking two dogs. And the dogs were having a riot. They just enjoyed themselves teasing each other and then running away. And he explained that one dog belonged to a farmhouse over there and one belonged to a farmhouse over there. And that these two dogs got together and they were feral dogs. That meant that they live outside. And this one only likes to come inside if it's storming and then he'll come inside. But he was afraid that my video camera tripod would be knocked over by these dogs running back and forth. But it's kind of fun. But in the process, we got talking about having cabooses on railroad beds. And we had to think about where we might be able to put a caboose. Did you inspire that? Do you have a caboose on some place?
Well, no, but it just occurred to me at the time, all those years ago, in the 1980s, railroad, and how fitting would it be to have a caboose there that could serve as a nature center. That was kind of my dream, and we could have different, you know, artifacts and paintings on the walls of plants and whatnot, and it could be like a little place where you could go in and learn.
The Natural History Survey has a truck like that, and they open it up. It closes down into a truck, but they have curtains or tents that come out and makes it into quite a portable museum.
Oh, so it's portable, so they can drive it. Yeah, that's a super.
You can't do that with a
no,
caboose, but there was that sort of conversation. And it was very healthy. There were only about six of us, and we were back and forth with each other about comments here and there, which says something about the value of camaraderie.
Yes, and just walking in your mind just walking frees your mind, and whatever ideas come up, you can say them and discuss them, and you're not even sitting around a table. You're just all walking the same way, pretty much. Ideas come up.
Today's meeting, when you were talking formally, it was a fairly formal meeting by comparison. But people did meet with each other. I talked to quite a lot of people.
Yes.
It was good. They had a fire outside, music, and you could walk through the 100 acres of Barnhart Prairie.
Yes, and beautiful programs and beautiful annual report, and it just showed, I like organizations where it's clear that somebody cares about it. You know, somebody cares about it. Whatever it is, I don't care, a hotel or a shop. And you can tell as soon as you walk in, does somebody care about it or not? And people really care about it.
And sometimes the word passion is used or obsession is used as a qualifier for those people. They have a passion. Sometimes that's a derogatory term. If you are trying to control mowing and somebody says, we understand that you have a passion, then the word passion is not such a friendly word. It means you're doing something that's different from what we do. We understand that you have that passion, but it's we want to be opposed to it.
Yeah, but oftentimes I find if people see that you have a passion for something, but they also see that it's a good thing, and they see that your passion is not through self-interest, it's just for something that you want to see happen for the good of everybody, more often than not, they will get behind you.
Yes, and most all the people that spoke today had that sort of passion.
Yes.
They were prepared to do things and explain them to others. And I think that was good for the audience because they hadn't had that sort of opportunity to hear some of the discussions we had today.
Yes. Right, and it was very like, let's find a way to do this. Let us find a way to do this. Let's not identify a bad guy.
So you also noticed differences in the town. You noticed that Market Street had changed, that the newspapers are having a problem. There's high-rise buildings on Green Street. There's some of the places that you remember are still afloat.
Green Street was funny. I used to work on campus at one time. And I never had a special fondness for Green Street, I'm going to say. Uh-huh. So, but it was kind of shocking to see those high-rises. But then I told myself it's actually a good thing if the town grows up and not out, because you don't want the town sprawling out into all the farmland and the prairie. You want it to grow up and be contained, and then you want to have a strict demarcation between the town and the country.
Yes, and putting sewers and water way out into the boondocks is an expensive event. Roads too. In that whole framework, we're kind of interested where the artists fit. Sometimes they get left out. It's easy for the school systems to dock off art. And sometimes sports come into the same category. But it's you hope there's as the high rises come, that there are spots where artists can be free
maybe,
to do things.
Maybe on the ground floor of the high rise, you see? You could have some free studios.
The ground floor is usually very expensive and usually for sales, so the artists get relegated to the second and third and fourth and fifth floor.
But you know, you could make some sort of regulations where if you build so many stories up, you will have this much space available to the community. I mean, you could have something like that.
They do that with sculptures. They decide that if a building is going up and it's going to be worth such and such, you're going to have to give us a sculpted piece.
That's
equivalent to a portion, perhaps a 0.1% of the budget for the whole building.
And then it happens because somebody thought about it, somebody wrote it in, and then it happens and you have sculptures.
Well, I think we've covered a few of your subjects. Yes. I'm so glad to have you here and to enjoy your company. And you've been inundated by people photographing you and talking to you. So it's time for, you've given me time at 8 o'clock at night. So I think that probably as much as we should do. And we thank you very much for doing
this. Well, thank you for having me on your show. It's been great fun to see you again and talk with you.
This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WEFT Champagne, 90.1 on your FM dial.
Now I'm back in the studio, and there were some interesting extensions of that conversation. We'd spoken about the value of community people doing this sort of work. There was a comment to say that 80% of the preservation that's happening in, I think, in Illinois, it might have been in the Midwest, is done by private citizens and private donations, and so we're very dependent on that sort of activist interest, and it behooves us to do the sort of thing that Grand Prairie Friends has been doing for a long time, is to educate people about opportunities and people who may want to donate a piece of property because it is much better in an organization that knows how to utilize it than it just sitting there in family vault. So there have been donations, grant monies, and individual donations that make this sort of thing possible. We had some fun discussion about the concept of a caboose. When you have a 1 mile strip, there's not very much parking opportunity on the section road. So then there was a thought about how you might be able to purloin a little bit of farmland to adjacent to put a caboose and have it partially as a museum and partially as a deposit for tools that you don't need to drag there every time. But in the process, we looked at the adjoining piece of railroad, the same railroad bed, between the section road, which is about a mile west of Gifford. And there's a bunch of trees growing on it. A little bit of it's cleared. But you could park cars linearly on that area. And so we wondered. I talked to the caretaker or steward that was walking his dogs and asked if who owned that piece of land. And he said, well, he thought the railroad might still own it because it didn't sell. And so a little later, I went to the Brookins Center for to look at the deeds to see who does own it. And it's owned by the elevator. Often elevators save a piece of line. It might be a mile long, so that they can back up rail cars. That's if the line reestablishes itself, or even if trucks are backed up along it. It's obviously not being used in that sense. And whereas on the short line, any trees are on the edge of the 100-foot wide corridor. There were trees growing in and on the ballast, and it would seem that it might be possible for the Grand Prairie Friends to rent or buy some of that corridor for parking, but also for an extension of the prairie. Yeah. So that brings discussion about how you do this in a small rural community that has had a tornado do devastating work. Part of it is that you need to look for the resources that are around that might be contiguous, but you then have to know that people may not necessarily be interested in prairie, especially if they're farmers who might want that land back. I think that I started to look at the areas around. The Grand Prairie Friends has got a grant to work with cemeteries, and just up the road between Gifford and Penfield, on the south side, about a mile south, there's a little well cemetery, and it has a small remnant prairie in the corner, cared for by people who have relatives and acquaintances buried in that cemetery. there's Penfield nearby. And at Penfield, unlike at Paxton, where the Royal High School has been taken down, the high school at Penfield has become a tractor museum. So you have another resource there. You have some history. The elevator has been removed, and the cattle yard has been removed. But there is that history of the train going through to Pontiac and turning around and coming back to Champaign and then going to Leroy in the other direction and coming back again. There is a little further east some rolling land that is in the hands of people who have hunting clubs, and it's a different sort of resource that's just reasonably near. To the north, there is a forest preserve with wetlands that come through from Ford County into Vermilion County, and those wetlands are serious places for wetland birds to occupy, and some of the cliffs that are above allow you to look down on that area. If you go west, there's Gordyville, which is an auction place, but it's also a venue for events. And you have a rolling moraine and with outwash creeks, and then down in front of the moraine is Flatville, and Penfield is is more more Irish. Flatville is more Lowland Deutsch or Friesland, and so there's an ethnic difference there, and those ethnic groups knew how to drain, and they got some very good soils. Drummers and Flanagans are some of the best soils in the world. And so if you go a little further, another part of that same Punk and Vine railroad line that has become a bed is been converted to an urban rail trail. And that in turn connects with a north-south corridor on Route 45 that we've been talking about, which could be a bicycle way to Paxton. And just relating these items, I need some sort of planning pizzazz. But then when you start to look at it and it gets to be a framework that you can discuss with other people, getting people to do things is very helpful. Just removing teasel and autumn olive trees is a case in point. At Coles County, the Grand Prairie Friends has been able to bring together 125 volunteers at once and plant trees, and then look at problems like deer that used to glean behind the combines, but the combines have improved, and so the gleaning is not so good, and you have a population explosion of deer, and they get to be starving, and they get to have disease, like Lyme disease, and so you have a community concern that eliminates some of those populations that eat the trees that the volunteers have just planted. So gradually you develop a community-wide concern for these sorts of plots of land. You find people who are already into things. The steward with his dogs, his wife is a monarch freak. And so she breeds monarch egg larva, pupa, an adult, and when she gets the adult, she takes it out and it gets released. So you have people who already have some of this sort of interest, and if done well, as the Grand Prairie Friends has been doing, this converts into the sort of 1,000 acres that they have, and so the camaraderie and banter back and forth about a caboose may not end up in a caboose. It might be too expensive to get a caboose, but you might be able to put a shipping container there, which would allow you to keep tools without vandals doing anything with it. And it might be a little ugly, so you have to think about these things. And so it's talking to each other, which is often rather important. Okay. This whole area is on a Bloomington moraine, a continental glaciation. And so you have that character, and you can dream of taking tourists off at Kankakee and running them adjacent to the railroad line. The roads always followed, or mostly followed, the railroad lines that came first. And the 45 coming south from Kankakee is right against the railroad, so there's not much room, but the area between the road and the railroad line is loaded with prairie. So if you could squeeze in a kiosk here and there, or a stopping place, then that would be interesting for ecotourists. If you come a little further, you get to Loder, and there's a road on the west side of the railroad line, as well as one that's 45 on the east side. So that also creates right-of-way, which is beyond the railroad line, and it is rich in prairie. And then just to the west of that again is Loder Cemetery, where the cemetery had set aside that hasn't been used or abused. And so Grand Prairie Friends, in that case, has bought 9 acres as a buffer zone around that corridor, and they sow it to plants that are picked from the easement, the cemetery set aside. And I think the state has provided alternative set aside. But that area is approximately 1 foot higher than the agricultural land nearby. Wow. Come a little further south and you get to Paxton and Prospect Cemetery, which is also rich in prairie. Then a little to the east of there is Pellville Cemetery. There's also an ethnic group that is Scandinavian, and so that is different from perhaps the Irish that you might find at Penfield or at Ivesdale or other places. And the intriguing thing is to take eco-tourists that have a natural history interest and a biology interest, as well as a sociological interest, and you look at stories. So when I went left Gifford and the short line, I went south to Ogden to go to 150, which parallels the Kickapoo Trail, and there was a Kickapoo retreat, which was a fundraiser at the Sleepy Creek Vineyard, just south of Oakwood. So, once again, an area that are not too far apart that could be visited by interested people. Just at Penfield, I remember that there was at one stage a storm and snow, and a train had been stopped at Penfield, and I think it was had the brakes on, but not too well, because the train eventually decided to move itself. So there's this legendary history which comes by word of mouth rather than by documentation, but it ran down the face of that moraine, and just that small story is interesting. So I think we're near to the end now, and thanks for listening. This is And thanks to Wendy for her presence and her involvement. This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WEFT Champaign.
And Dave on the board. As always, the views and opinions expressed are solely those of the speakers and no one else. It is moments before noon here at WEFT Champaign. We are 90.1 FM. We are also community radio for East Central Illinois. And it's time now for Shruti, Music of India.
Mm-hmm.